Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hello, welcome to another fantastic book club. Very excited to have my guest, who is Richard Ayoade, and his book that he has written all on his own with someone help with the illustrations is The Book That No One Wanted to Read. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for having me on this podcast.
It's very exciting. Well, I've been trying to get you on Rahalastapa, the main podcast, for a long time. So this is exciting for me to have you for this little bit. And also, we had lots of computer problems, and that is funny because you were in the IT crowd, and so that's funny that it went wrong.
It's good that that's become prophetic.
Look, tell me first of all, Richard. We're a very serious book club here, and we talk very seriously about books.
Good.
Tell me about books you've written before the book that no one wanted to read.
Yes. Well, I've written 3 books, which I guess you would say are kind of books to do with films, but have a sort of parodic feel to them, or they're via Faber, who do all those director on director series, and Herzog has a big thing to say about the state of the medium. He'll release that through Faber, and so it seemed funny perhaps to try and publish with them and to have this kind of ludicrous series of books talking about the state of cinema and all of that kind of stuff. The first one was like an interview with a director in that kind of realm, one of those books. And the second one was like those books that tell you how to write films and how all stories are essentially the same and here are the rules, like a Robert McKee thing. And the last one, I guess you would say, is in the monograph tradition, where say Pauline Kael does a big book about Citizen Kane and gives you all the textual analysis. But rather than some great masterpiece of cinema, it's about View from the Top, a Gwyneth Paltrow rom-com, a flight stewardess, you know, expose.
I did listen to the audiobook of that one a year or two ago. It's incredibly enjoyable. I mean, it's very funny. I've not seen the film. It did make me want to watch the film, but I decided not to watch the film.
Well, you're not alone in that decision. I think many people have decided to swerve View from the Top. It's an interesting piece of work, for sure. I don't know that it could be made again. Although I think Netflix now, I think there are films coming back that are in the View from the Top tradition of expensive films that feel like they could not really be screened to huge numbers of people.
Well, I had a quick look at it today to remind myself about it, and it's very. I mean, you really need to read, or I think preferably listen to you reading it on the audiobook. But it's it sort of transcends sarcasm. It's sarcastic, but it's sort of I love anything that goes into way too much thought about something that wasn't designed to be really thought about, and that is what this book is. It's a long. It's a long look at a film that doesn't need more than a paragraph written about it, really, isn't it? But by doing so, it reveals a lot about you, actually, as well as the film. There's autobiographical elements to this as well.
Yes, there's sort of fake autobiography in the sense that I like people who use analysis as an excuse for self revelation. So I like the idea of saying, and in a way, I'm much like Botticelli's Venus, and tell us why. So, yes, I like the idea of taking something that no one would wish to have discussed in depth. No one making View from the Top thought they were making the most important film of all time. So it seemed funny to treat it as if it was the most important film of all time and really relish details which you imagine will not necessarily have been thought about at all.
No, it's true. But as you say, as much as it is a parody of it's sarcastic and maybe slightly mean about the film, it's more about criticism itself that is the real target of it. So it's enjoyable on a level, because you could think, oh, this is a bit nasty and mean to pick on poor old Gwyneth Paltrow.
Well, yes, my hope was that, you know, in the unlikely incident or situation where our paths crossed, I mean, I don't know, maybe I would be being sued or something, and that I could look and feel that I had not desecrated humanity, and that the target really is the idea of someone who's taken themselves terribly seriously. I mean, she knew what she was doing, and it's very clear that her part is, this is not the part into which she is pouring her soul, and everyone's fine with that. Mike Myers is a brilliant comic performer, but this probably was something that only took 2 days, and that's absolutely fine. So in a way, my hope was to not take a film that's so self-evidently terrible that you're kind of kicking something while it's down, but something where everyone is more than capable of taking care of themselves. Mark Ruffalo, everyone knows, is very good. He's a great actor, but there's something slightly silly about just even pretending to be in these scenes. There's something inherently funny about Gwyneth Paltrow pretending to be someone who worked on a low budget airline. And there's just, she will have never been on a low-budget airline. I mean, it's impossible. It's just, there's something funny sometimes when you get someone playing, you know, a brain surgeon, and it's some, person who's obviously a real valley kid from Los Angeles who would think that would be the squarest thing to possibly ever have done.
Well, it's good, and there's some stuff about sliding doors in there which I'm upset, which would probably be my choice of writing a whole book about a film, would be sliding doors. I have a lot to say about the film, which I have largely said. I did like your observation, which I probably isn't what I've made, that everyone in the film specifically asked for Grosh.
It's so strange. It's such a specifically odd order to make in a film that's trying to have as broad an appeal as possible, that in a way it would be less disruptive just to have inserted a commercial for Grosh. In that, you know, there used to be a kind of a clown sort of comedy game. Did you ever come across this where someone, say, auditioning to play Hamlet, but they also know that the director's casting a washing commercial, like for a washing up powder, and so they have to subtly work that into the Hamlet audition by right. making gentle lathering movements. And so it's a yes. kind of game of where the audience knows what's going on, and it's quite a fun sort of silly game to play. That's what the Grosh situation feels like in Sliding Doors.
Well, it really doesn't feel like it's... maybe it was product placement, maybe they got paid. But I don't think it is. I think Peter Howitt, Joey yeah. from Bread, who yes. created this work and directed it and was in it occasionally as one character, I think he just thought, what cool people like is Grosh, yeah. and therefore everyone's going to drink Grosh. And I don't think he got a penny from Grosh for doing it.
Yes, maybe he just thought, look, let's be specific here. This is about reality. This is about truth. People don't order a beer, just a beer. They'll use a brand. And yes. Grosh is what's happening in London now. And inadvertently, we're giving Grosh even more oxygen currently.
Yes, I've just disappeared from my screen, yes. but hopefully... I don't think that matters
as
long as...
That's Peter Howitt intervening.
That is, you know, it's a terrible thing. I think I will not risk...
Okay, yes.
coming back, if you can
that's
bear
okay.
not seeing me.
Yes. Do you want my picture to remain up?
Yeah, I do want your picture, sure. because I love to see you. Chris is trying to reestablish me as long as we're recording.
Oh, yes, fine.
It's an audio podcast. So
okay,
it doesn't matter.
Yes.
Good. Well, look, let's move on to as much as I would like to talk to you about Sliding Doors for an hour, but maybe I'll get you on to Rahulastapa to do that
yes.
another time. Let's talk about the book that no one wanted to read, and tell me, you know, what is this book, and why did you want to write this book?
Well, it's I realised that I have a great difficulty in describing books that I've done effectively or in any way that makes them sound appealing, and this continues, unfortunately, in that tradition. But I think it is essentially about a book who has never been read, who in an old dusty library encounters a child who takes an interest in this book. And it's really a story about the child persuading the book to allow it to be read, I suppose. That's the story.
Yes. That's the story. And why did what prompted you to go? Well, A, why did you want to write for children? I know you have to have children.
Yes.
Might be the reason. But and what this is, I mean, it's a particular Richard Iardi way of coming at things, I think. But why did you want to personify a book?
Well, I think it was one of those things where just the idea occurred and it just that this is what was the outworking of it. So I didn't sit down to try and write a book for children. It's just one of those ideas that rattled around for a while. And then I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. And so this is just slightly what emerged, which is not a terrific anecdote, but there wasn't any instrumentalizing. And I don't know, I've written one other book that will arrive at some point later, also for children, but I don't necessarily have any plans to do more or for it to become a thing I do, unless another idea occurred. So yeah, that's the not great Parkinson story, other than just going, I don't know. There's something about the idea of what would happen if you tried to narrate a book from the point of view of a book. And you have lots of stories, which is, you know, in children's books where an animal is talking or a monster or a child. And I just started thinking, what would it feel like if a book told you a story, and if a book was very annoyed at how books were talked about and portrayed and stories, and how no one really understands the danger that books are in and how dependent they are on finding a reader, and how how upset that must make all books, and that books are to pulp. If a book is not appealing, that a book is literally destroyed, shredded and turned into toilet paper, seemed quite high stakes situation for books trying to please their readers.
Well, it is. And look, I because I've got kids, I read a lot of kids' books, and this one is, you know, it's of itself, and that's a good thing. I think what's lovely about it as an adult, I would read this book anyway, even if I didn't have kids, and I'm sure many comedy fans will, but it's enjoyable for the adults to read it. It's quite a, I mean, it's a philosophical book, which I think a lot of the best kids' books are, even if they're very, very simple, which this one is not, isn't a super simple book for like young kids. But I think when you get into the philosophy and things that make you, there's plenty of questions in there to make people think and children think, which I love.
Well, you're very kind. Well, I think, well, with having children is that they ask a lot of questions and you realize that you don't know anything. And how the extent to which you're just busking and taking a lot of things for granted that really you shouldn't. And so, yes, in a way, hopefully those questions are sort of fun and enjoyable things to be asking, and aren't too much in the realm of a test or some sense of
they're very, you know, I think like what is a book is a great question to ask when reading a book, and beautiful to describe it. You describe it as a delivery vehicle, basically to transport ideas to people. But even discussing that, or when a tree falls in a forest, does it make a sound? Those are great things. Yeah, those are just the kind of questions you want to talk to.
I came up with a tree in the forest. That was me.
That's your question.
And I'm pleased finally to establish copyright on it, because it had been in the culture unremunerated for too long.
But also to subvert it and question the question as well, which you managed to do within the book, I think is going. If a book becomes illegible, what is it? That's a great question. So if a book is, if you can't read a book, what does it become? You know, these are the, and what age range is this book aimed at, or did you not think of that, or do you not care about
that? Well, I didn't think about that. You become aware of these questions when people say, what are we going to do with this now that you've come along with this ridiculous pile of words? And so I don't know. I think 8 and over would be fine. I also think there's sometimes a kind of pressure for children to display precocity. So I can see people really pushing their children to read books that they should not be reading, you know, sort of nudging them towards going, I think you might like this Hemingway book. And you go, I don't think you are going to like this Hemingway book. Not because you can't physically read the words. It's just, I just don't know how interested you are in, you know, bullfighting at this stage. That comes later, obviously, when you're 12 and 13, that's when you really like to get into bullfighting. So, yeah, I think over 8, but it remains to be seen. Again, a huge flaw in the sales pitch. I just don't know. You know, that I've sometimes spent, not lots of times, but times with musicians, and you have this great curiosity about how they make music and what they do, and they literally just, they're not trying to be difficult. They just go, they're not even apologizing. What I like about musicians, they don't even apologize for not being able to talk about it. They just go, I don't know. They just, and I feel really bad and obstreperous, but I wish I knew what age. What age do you think it would be appropriate?
I think you're probably right, but what I like and why I think it succeeds, and what it having read a lot of children's books, I think the ones that work are the ones that don't patronize, and this feels like a book written for adults. And I think kids will appreciate that, even though, you know, it's is written in a way that certainly kids will understand. But there are words in there that a kid will have to say, what does that mean? Or I'm not sure what that had to pronounce that if I'm reading it. And that's a brilliant thing in a book. That's what a book should be.
Yeah.
As an adult, you should be reading books and going, oh, Christ, what's that? I've never seen that word before. What's that?
Yes.
So, you know, that's part of the process. But I think by treating the reader, and the reader in this book is a character in the book as well, which is a really lovely idea as well. But by treating them as by not going, right, I'm going to write for kids, I think that is absolutely the correct response. And I don't think Roald Dahl sat down and thought, what's appropriate to write for children, did he? I think he just wrote what he thought.
He didn't seem to. No. So, and, oddly, Roald Dahl was one of the first writers where I remember reading about how he wrote, and I remember loving hearing that he had all of these pencils sharpened in a row, and his he had an electric pencil sharpener on his desk, and he had this little tray over his lap in the shed. And I had a book about how he wrote. It's about 9 or 10, and just since then, the idea of a writer and the idea of books and the way he talks about books and the way he kind of talks to you directly and says, okay, so now we're going to do this, I found really exciting. I always loved it. I always find somehow it quite silly when someone pretends that we don't know this is a book or we don't know this is a film. Or I do like that sense of, it's why credit sequences are fun. You know, there's no sense of just going, oh, maybe this is real, the A-Team. Maybe this really happened. And he goes, this didn't happen. This is to delight you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, I think that's all lovely. And there's loads of, there's lots of things. I think, I like the bit you talk about bestsellers and what that means. But also, I think you're right. The word bestseller should only be one book. That's, if you're going to have bestseller, it should be one book.
Yes
probably by J.K. Rowling, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's the best.
Maybe Richard Osman.
I think it's the Bible. The Bible's the bestseller,
the
surely.
Bible, yeah,
the, and then
yeah,
all the rest well. are more sellers or better sellers than others. Yes, I think in the book, I think the book suggests they should just be called more sellers.
It's very, so there's loads of jokes, there's loads of things to bend your mind and think about. You talk about books with tigers, you should run away from tigers, but it reminded, there's a book called, which I quite like, it won the Waterstones Prize, illustrated book category, by Lizzie Stewart, called There's a Tiger in the Garden.
Oh, yes.
And there's a bit in it, so there's a girl who's told there's a tiger in the garden, she won't believe it, and then she finds the tiger, and she says, "Are you real?" says Nora. "I don't know," says the tiger. "Are you?" Nora thinks about this for a long time. "I don't know," she admits. "How can you tell?" And the tiger says, "I'm not sure you can." Which I kind of, that is quite mind-blowing for a book that's aimed at 3 or 4-year-olds. Because, of course, neither of them are real anyway. And so...
Yes, that was a good exchange. I like it when children... And children are really into questioning what different realities... Like any child with a soft toy if you say so, is that hungry? If you say, is your toy tiger hungry? One, they might go, how dare you, this isn't a toy, and we'll give you the toy's full name. And they'll either say, it doesn't eat anything, it's a toy, why are you being so ridiculous? Or they'll have a really elaborate meal plan, like, you know, peanut butter and worms. And so I like how fluid it is. And then if you go with them for a little bit for a while, they'll just go, no, I also washed this tiger in the machine. And so I like that you're just never able to second guess what children say, that, and they're completely unrepentant about changing the rules in the middle of a sentence.
And that imagination, you know, and it's my daughter last night came downstairs. You know, she's seven, and we just watched Harry Potter 5, which I think, again, as kids, as the films go on, they become much, much more inappropriate for the young kids who want to watch them. But she came, having seen, like, death and all this sort of stuff, she came downstairs and said she was worried about dying. And I kind of remember that, those sort of times when you'd lie in bed as a seven-year-old worrying about what death meant and what infinity meant, and getting your mind absolutely blown by the idea of the universe never ending and what's beyond, you know, and if God created the world, who created God, and all those stupid questions that you ask yourself as a seven-year-old. But they absolutely are, at that, when you see it, it's happened for the first time. It's just mind-blowingly terrifying.
Yeah.
And so
I say those are still pretty good questions.
They are good questions, they're still scary.
I think they remain the good questions, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, but I think it's sort of interesting to pose this stuff. And now, I kind of want, you know, to begin with, I thought it was going to be a book. I don't want to give too many spoilers away for our adult audience listening to this. But I begin with, because the book's sort of reluctant to be read. The book that no one wanted to read is reluctant to be read, and it's sort of hiding away. And I thought it was going to, which I suppose, I think it slightly is about this, but it's about, I thought the book, we were going to have a lesson about how you have to get out, you know, have to risk being judged in order to.
Yes.
And it's in order to live, but it's terrifying, the idea of someone judging you.
Yes.
And what you are and who you are and whether you're any good.
Yes.
Is so frightening that in some senses hiding away in a forgotten corner of the library is a response, but it's not the right response. Is that something you wanted to look at?
Well, again, it was one of those things where you try not to have a specific didactic message, because it just ends up being in some way silly, simply because it's never one thing. You know, there are very good reasons not to be overly open. There are good reasons to protect yourself and tentatively to find out about someone. I think one of the things that happens conversationally is that people spend a little time testing one another to see whether they're willing to be able to be seen or read in a certain way. So I don't think, hopefully it shouldn't land on just one thing, but hopefully the idea is that the reader and the book meeting one another, which is what maybe you hope for in reading or writing, is that there is a kind of meeting where both something happens in a way that can't happen without either one. And so maybe but all of these things, I'd have to say, are completely all things that I would have thought about all since being married to my wife, Lydia, who is extremely relational and a huge reader and would, so in a way, I feel I was probably just ventriloquizing ideas that she will be able to express much better than I, and will, I'm sure, express much better than I in a much better book. Again, a great sales pitch for me for this particular book.
I know people are going to buy this book and love this book, so you don't have to worry about the sales pitch, because it's going to sell, and rightly so. But kids will love it. I absolutely know. I haven't, because I didn't have a physical copy of it. I haven't yet tried it out with my daughter. But I will do as soon as I have a physical copy. But no, I'm sure. I mean, I know she will love it. And because again, slight spoilers here. If you are interested in being surprised by the book, but it's sort of about the book turns out to be empty. I hope that's not too much of a giveaway in this podcast. And so it's about the creative urge and the fact that any, you know, a blank page and a blank book is open to whatever you as a person wants to put in it. Do you consider, I mean, maybe you were going to do this, but it seems like you should sell this with the book. And or do you think that's too, is that too much of a giveaway?
Yes,
you should have the book as a double package. So you have the book and you have the book about the book.
Yes, there should be a book about the book and an empty book in which to write a new book. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's just paper costs at this stage. They're just looking to cut. Hopefully, you know, ideally they just release it as a GAS or a PDF. Just to, prevent shipping. But yes, yeah, I like things that, I don't know, even, you know, this might sound too highfalutin, but I've always loved things like A Pale Fire and books about books and things that talk about the process of it. And or just something like, say, the film Singing the Rain. There seems something very kindly about being invited in and someone showing, and also quite childish about saying, come and have a look at how this thing works. And or like Morecambe, I think that's what was I loved about Morecambe Wise, that they just went, we're about to put on a show. There's something really nice about that, because you sort of feel on their side, or the Muppets or something. So my hope was more to be in that kind of tradition. Having started Nabokov, I downed the kind of ambition to make it more relatable.
But I love the idea, you know, and I think this will, and certainly for someone like my daughter, I'm sure, you know, it will spark so much. And she's, you know, the creative, as all kids are, they're all creative, either drawing or coming up with stories or just coming up with nonsense. The mind is so creative. So the idea of just, you know, realizing, oh, I can go away and I'm allowed to create a book. It's just such a nice, you know, such a strong and message. I mean, it's a book, it's a you know, it's a love story with a book, and that, which is a great thing. You know, it's encouraging people to read, which is a good thing. It's sort of admitting that, you know, it is about it's that connection that you find with, and you don't find it with every book, of course. You don't.
No.
You don't find it with many books. You get a connection, and a book will stay with you. And I think that really happens for kids, doesn't it? There are books that you read as a kid.
Yes, for sure.
Is there a book that you read as a kid that would have stuck with you to this day?
Well, I loved Roald Dahl. You know, I really loved him. And also because my mum was Norwegian, so I felt really connected to the fact that he was Norwegian. There weren't many. There was, of course, Aha. That was a big deal as well. Again,
yes.
Norway. And so that was a big thing. And Watership Down, I loved. And but also Spike Milligan, which was a bit, I knew it was a bit too complicated for me and I didn't understand all of it, but it seemed there was something, I don't know, there seemed there's something good over there and I wanted to look at, I don't know, to try and understand it. And so...
Yeah, again, but that is, again, it is people who treated kids as that, you know, he's someone who didn't write down to kids, does he? He sort of understood the imagination, he understood madness, and that again, I think, feeds into being a child. But also I mean, there was something, he wasn't scary. I think Roald Dahl was a little bit like, as a person, you know, it was a bit scary. I suppose Spike, you'd be, he could be scary.
Yeah.
I don't think you got that as a reader.
Yeah.
But you know, but it was, you knew, you know, maybe it's why Jimmy Savile was so successful. You knew there was something inappropriate about him and that made him somehow, there was something, and I'm not saying that about, about Spike Milligan in any way, but you know, the inappropriateness is what, as a child, makes you go, oh, you're not like a normal grown up. You're behaving in a way that you shouldn't behave, and it's you know, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? To as a reader, I suppose.
Yeah. Well,
sorry for bringing Jimmy Savile.
Well, it was inevitable.
It was otherwise a good point.
But with Spike Milligan, you just felt that he had a good sense of what was silly all the time, and that he knew that adults didn't always know what was up, and that he was happy to point out how ridiculous they were. And I think Roald Dahl was the same. He would just go, well, look at these people who are supposedly teachers and grown-ups and they're meant to be doing that, and I'm going to show you what they're really like. And so that was always quite thrilling as a child, that, oh, you can, that they might not be right adults, that they might not always know what's going on. And so that's, I guess, plays to your kind of vanity as a child, that somehow you might be vindicated in some of the things that you like, and it's okay to like sweets. And and just that his enjoyment of things, Roald Dahl and Spike Milligan, they really feel like they enjoyed things, and that's quite nice to be around.
And I think, again, the jokes are not, you know, they're not dialing it down for kids. They're not trying, you know, a lot of children's books, and some of them still are funny, will try to go, okay, we'll do the poo, the wee, we'll do all this sort of stuff. That's what kids like.
Yes.
But to actually, and this book as well, your book as well as Spike Milligan and Roald Dahl, it's, you know, these are the quality of jokes that you would put in an adult book. And I think that's, you know, it's not obviously you wouldn't necessarily put in some of the jokes you put in an adult book in a kid's book, but it's the quality and it's the framing of the joke, and it's the, you know, the inventiveness of the ideas. It's, I think, because as a kid, I was really into comedy right from the beginning, and certainly as a teenager, but even before that, you know, I knew the difference between what was good comedy and what was, you know, what was duff comedy or what was hack comedy. I knew at least that difference, and I knew when something exciting came along. And you would, you know, you really would. You'd go, oh, you would read Spike Milligan and go, wow, this guy is really funny. Not, this isn't Giles Brandreth putting together a silly dictionary of funny words, which was still a good book, Giles. But this is something I almost shouldn't be allowed to see, but I am allowed to see.
Yes, well, and you also have the sense that they can't just be done in another, how to put it, in another form. Like sometimes, you know, I don't know whether you had those sort of bumper books of jokes for kids. And there's something always a bit ghostly about them because they're disembodied, you know, and it somehow doesn't feel right that anyone ought to be able to do a joke. The thing about, particularly about Spike Milligan, is that only he could do those jokes. And you feel that he can, in a certain sense, help himself from making those jokes. Yes. And so the hope for this was just, well, what would come if you just followed this premise through, just what would occur. So in a way, I wasn't necessarily, in a certain way, trying to make it funny. You know, I didn't think, oh, well, this is a book with lots of jokes. But maybe you start to realize that maybe something being interesting means it has to sometimes be funny if you're a certain kind of personality. I think I maybe wrongly equate funny with being interesting, which is not the right thing to do sometimes.
Because being funny is about, you know, I think being truly funny is about seeing something from, it's a weird combination, because it's seeing something from a new perspective, but that is also recognisably true. And that's, but those two things colliding, it's not obviously all jokes, but it's something at the very basis of a joke is the collision of a new idea, but it being a true idea, but it's somehow hiding in plain sight. Back to Jimmy Savile. There's been this amazing...
When will your book about Jimmy Savile be finally coming out?
pretty soon.
Good, yes.
Pretty soon. But you know, I think that's what, you know, the things that come up in this are mind-boggling to an adult and make an adult think. So, you know, I think to present that to a child as well and make them think about those things whilst being entertaining and whilst coming up with perfectly good and rational, humorous ideas about these things, I think is great. But I think it will, you know, I think just that the whole, you know, the journey is to spark off creativity. And I think that's what's so smart about this. And you work on a different, level to, and I'm not saying it's a better, that makes it sound like it's better than other people, Richard. I'm not saying that.
Well, let's not rule this out. Can we? I don't think we should be ruling this out. It may be better than everything that's ever been written.
your brain doesn't work like everyone's brain. And that is a very good thing. And I think this book is about that, you know, it's going to encourage that and No, it's, you know, it's just it really is one of the. If I read this as a kid, I think I know it would really have blown my mind and really, you know, it would be one of the books that stuck with me if I'd read this as a kid, and I think it probably will as an adult as well. Oh, so it's
you're very kind to say
it's
that.
It's very enjoyable. Now what do you think? I mean, obviously the criticism that gets levelled at celebrity authors, and I think we have to call you a celebrity author.
I'd come back in a relatively robust way against that. I think you need a personality to be a celebrity. I completely have a sense of the inward groan that emits if you are aware of someone doing one thing and then they're doing another thing. It just is exhausting. You can barely accommodate the idea of someone in one arena and here they are in another. And coupled with the thought of me, which I can barely accommodate myself, it's enough to make you leap in front of anything at a certain velocity coming towards you. So, yes, all I can say is I didn't quite intend to, and rest assured they will not be coming thick and fast. I think hopefully much like a gnat, maybe if you just stand still, it will just not come near you, and it will disperse. That's my earnest hope for those who, understandably, and I completely am on your side, would feel that about me writing a book.
I think, I mean, to defend comedians especially, seem to, and writing kids' books, I mean, it does seem a good match for comedians to write kids' books. And I think it also... all comedians really are writers. And I think that's the thing that gets lost. It's not like you've just been a bloke telling jokes on TV. I mean, sometimes you've been a bloke doing stuff that isn't written by you, but you know, you've always been writing stuff and creating stuff. And so you are a writer. So it's not like someone just popping out the woodwork and you've written it yourself, which is something that doesn't happen with all books, although you got a book to write itself this time, so maybe that doesn't
count.
But yes, I mean, I do get it. My wife's a children's author, and I meet lots of children's authors, and obviously, like, it's there's a frustration in, I suppose, but it's more from the point. I think the frustration's more directed at the media, you know, that they obviously inevitably go for the celebrity books over the ones written by non-celebrities, but that's, you know, that's, I don't know, it's if you're getting people out there into bookshops and buying books, I don't think that's a bad thing for everyone.
And there is I still think ultimately whether something is, there are obviously exceptions, but I think over long periods of time good things out, you know, the books that are still around from 30 years ago tend to be good, and there's, you know, there are things that fade away, and I don't know how many people are keeping up to date with Jackie Collins currently, but that for whatever reason it just seems to shake out. And if something, not to say, you know, as Orson Welles said, you know, posterity is a sham, that you can have really bad things still remain and good things can get lost, but I think there's still the hope that good things can stay around. And for this myself, I view myself as a kind of amateur, so I don't view myself as a kind of professional in any sphere. Each one is a kind of amateur undertaking, so I think to that extent professionals within any of the fields, I again can completely understand their frustration that this rank amateur should deign to be piddling in this pool.
But I also feel about, and the more I do this, I was reading, I've been reading Janie Godley's book, which might have been out by the time we do this, if I do talk to her. But, you know, the pool of the kind of people who get to write books is such a narrow strata of society that, you know, everyone should, and this is what this book is about. This book is about everyone should be writing or creating and getting stuff down on paper, whatever you want to do. And, you know, and I think that's it. There shouldn't be anger at anyone attempting to do something. I think it's when publishing is a closed shop, I don't know if it, I feel there's more democracy in books than almost anything else that a writer gets to do, because there's less interference. But that's easy for me as a white man who's managed to get some of my books published to say. But
yes, well, I think you can publish it. I mean, it's not something I know a great deal about, and so I can, float on in my bubble of absolute ignorance as to how the world operates. But, I remember being at school and at the end of an English class, people reading out their stories. And when someone read a good one, it was genuinely thrilling. And I remember still some of those stories. I can sometimes think of them, and I can think particularly of the ones that were funny, and it just being great to hear them. And I really would like it if it felt more that things could be done for the joy of it. And I think in a way, one of the good things about stuff in Britain is that because it's not, I mean, to compare it to America, I think a lot of stuff is done for the joy. It's not huge money. It's not big stakes. Often, things here, comparing, say, Edinburgh Festival to big comedy festivals in America. So I think you do get that transmission of things for their own sake and joy for joy's sake.
That's good. Well, that is fantastic. Are you reading anything yourself at the moment, Richard, that you would like to recommend for other authors?
Oh, okay.
Or yourself?
I'm really enjoying the John Updike Rabbit series.
Okay.
And that, I think, is very good. I am also reading François Truffaut's writing on film, which is great. And he's like a brilliant example of someone who was not from a kind of a highfalutin background, fell in love with French literature, just loved Balzac, was a kind of truant runaway, and became this great bibliophile, writer, filmmaker, and kind of felt really transformed by just loving books and creativity. And you get that from his films. I think in a way he's the best adapter of literature there's ever been in films. And he does it by not really trying to disguise that they're books that he's adapting. So, yeah, I'd recommend those two.
Great. Brilliant. Well, look, everyone should... I want to recommend On Top, A.O. Eddie On Top, which is really fantastic. Audiobook, definitely. I think probably the book that no one wanted to read. Are you doing it? Is there going to be an audiobook version of it?
I think there will be, yes.
Yeah.
At some stage.
Okay. I think the printed copy or the Kindle copy, I presume, will still have the illustrations.
Yes, and the illustrations. Tor Freeman did the illustrations, so very grateful to her. Also, Deborah Eisenberg, I'd recommend. That's the other. Deborah Eisenberg and Wallace Shawn.
Okay, good. We've got some good recommendations. We've got Richard's books are absolutely fabulous. And are you going to do any more films?
I'm going to try to. Yeah, we're trying to do one. I mean, so you'll know if it's failed, if nothing happens in the next couple of years. So just keep watching the skies.
We will. Well, always, whatever you do, Richard, it's always fantastic. You're a man of many talents. You can, when you were judging Roast Battle, that's a very different skill than writing a children's book.
In which you were funny. Well, you're doing a very different thing there to this.
Yes.
I think we grew up in an area or a time when extreme specialization was somehow seen as an achievement. Like, God, that person's incredible at darts. But when you look at it, you go, I don't know that that's normal, just to be hyper focused at one tiny thing. I mean, I really love darts, but most people do loads of things. And, I also think I'm protected by my inability to excel at any one area. So I end up just doing loads of the sort of things.
Well, it's good to see. I think it's especially good to see you on those kind of shows, because I think they, it's just, there's some kind of sideways you know, again, it's just you're not the typical person who would go on there, and you're extremely good. So,
well, you're very kind.
Whatever Richard is doing, just go and look at it and buy it and see it. That is what I'm saying. Thanks so much for doing this, Richard. I hope we can tempt you into the theatre at some point to talk more about more things. And thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for producing it. And I think everything's technically, apart from the cameras going off halfway through, it's been technically quite good.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much.
See you next week, whatever that will be. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.